From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today is Thursday, August 11th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. The rioters in England use social media websites to organize. Now the government there is considering how to respond.
We are working with the police, the intelligence services and industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder and criminality.
And later, protesting high prices in Israel.
In a way, many people feel that the pact between us as citizens and our government was broken and we want it back.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. British Prime Minister David Cameron appeared before Parliament today. He defended his government's handling of the riots in London and in other cities this week. Cameron admitted the initial police response was inadequate, but he said what he's calling the fight back is well underway, and he vowed to track down and punish those responsible. The Prime Minister also spoke about the role social media played in these disturbances. The World's technology correspondent Clark Boyd is following that part of the story. What exactly did the Prime Minister say today?
Well, right after he spoke, you saw a lot of things popping up on the internet saying that he said he's going to shut down all social networks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought it would be good, Lisa, if we played a clip of David Cameron and what he actually said. Here we go.
Free flow of information can be used for good, but it can also be used for ill. So we are working with the police, the intelligence services and industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder and criminality.
That's Prime Minister David Cameron speaking earlier today. Is he, when he says whether it would be right to stop people from communicating with these services, is he talking about whether it would be legally advisable or technologically possible?
I think he's talking about a little bit of both, Lisa. One of the things that's come out in the wake of these riots is that people are using some of these tools to perhaps organize or incite some of this rioting that's going on. The BlackBerry messaging service has been singled out, although many would argue that that's not really an open social network. It's more of a closed network that you can use to communicate with a group of people via text messaging. So it seems like the British government is trying to decide whether it is technically possible to limit the people who can use these services, and then also trying to figure out whether it's legally and morally right to do such a thing.
So can they actually do what they're talking about in the British government? I mean, can they shut down either the BlackBerry messaging or these other social media outlets?
Well, Lisa, I think that there are ways that the British government could go about doing this. However, I think that there are compelling reasons for them to be hesitant in the amount that they're going to do. For example, the police have been saying that even something like this BlackBerry messaging service, people have been receiving messages and then forwarding the messages onto the police. It then becomes a tool that the police can use to help quell the violence and also possibly even be used in legal cases against those who are sending them out.
So police can use them for their own purposes. And Clark, this is filtering right in to Britain's struggle, which has been ongoing with issues around freedom of speech versus security.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, there are members of David Cameron's own party, the Conservative Party, who have come out very much against any kind of blockages of this technology like David Cameron was talking about. This is Patrick Mercer, who is a Conservative member of Parliament. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The point is that we have relatively small numbers of people imposing their will upon the largely decent masses of this country. If we start interfering with things like BlackBerry, then we start interfering very seriously and to my mind, quite wrongly, with our own liberties. We mustn't do that. That is actually giving in to the thugs.
Clark, I wonder, since you have covered internet censorship in many places, China, North Africa, if there are any similarities to what's happening right now in Britain.
Well, I think what you're seeing is a very similar struggle at the government level to try to do this balance between liberty, on the one hand, letting people communicate, say what they want to say, and security in a given situation. However, I have to say, in most of the instances that I've covered, especially in the North African examples, trying to shut these things down usually provokes a serious backlash, a political backlash against whoever is trying to shut it down on the one hand. And then, quite frankly, it seems to me that, that the people who want to communicate and are trying to communicate always seem to find new and different ways around it.
All right. The World's technology correspondent, Clark Boyd. Thank you, Clark.
You're welcome, Lisa.
You can check out what people around the world are saying on Twitter about the riots and explore the rest of our ongoing coverage, too. That's all at theworld.org. People in Britain have been gripped all week by the riots and their aftermath, and that includes a young Syrian playwright. He arrived in London from Damascus on Sunday, just as the violence was starting to spread. Mohammed Al-Attar traveled to the British capital to premiere a short play about the protests in his own country, Syria. But he couldn't avoid getting swept up in the debate about the unrest in England. The World's Laura Lynch met up with the playwright hours before the curtain went up at the Royal Court Theatre in London.
The coffee shop in the basement of the Royal Court Theatre is just opening up for the day. The first cappuccinos are being brewed. Mohammed Al-Attar settles into a seat near the back. He may have arrived here with Syria on his mind, but when he saw what was happening on London streets, especially in the East End, Al-Attar was shocked.
I love East London. I'm really attached emotionally to East London.
The playwright lived here last year, studying for his master's degree and working with the disadvantaged in some of the same neighborhoods hit by violence. Al-Attar has been dismayed by the reaction of his friends here. He says they refuse to consider the underlying problems he saw, discrimination and a lack of opportunity.
You have to condemn the criminal actions. There's nothing to justify to burn stores and to steal things. Never. But also, I think it's you cannot be that superficial in dealing with and condemning this.
Al-Attar is hesitant to draw parallels with Syria, though he thinks in both cases people are challenging existing class and social structures. Instead, it's easier for him to talk about his new play, even if he admits it wasn't easy to write.
It was a tough task for many, many reasons, actually, to write about something is happening right now at the moment. So I wrote many drafts.
It's called Online. It follows the conversation between young Syrians as they live through 1 week of the uprising, all of it by email. Here, Sharif writes to his girlfriend Salma, who is studying in Paris, just after returning from a street protest in Damascus.
Where are you? I need to speak to you. I don't have any credit, so I can't call you, and the internet here is so that I hardly get online. I'm ashamed at what I've done. It makes me sick. I saw my friends getting beaten up right in front of me and I couldn't do anything about it. I didn't say anything. I didn't make a sound. All the words inside me just dried up. People in the street were standing.
I just got your email. I wanted to call you, but I realised you'd be asleep. I've been so worried about you and I can't stop thinking about Samir and Shadi and Reem. I keep on going onto Samir's Facebook page.
For Al-Attar, the play was a chance to reveal the details of the lives of the young people caught up in the tension of the times. It also reflects his own feelings every time he steps out the door to protest, especially since several of his friends have disappeared into Syrian jails.
Fear is still there. When you are in the street, you are, of course, not comfortable. You have to get killed. So it's not an easy decision, but also it's a big relief. You feel that, okay, I'm doing a huge step towards breaking this fear barrier inside me, which is, I think, it's still the biggest obstacle for everybody.
How are you? This isn't easy. I'm really having to force myself to write to you. I still don't understand why you didn't pick up when I called, and why you didn't even try to get hold of me when I was tearing my hair out, desperate to find out what was happening to you all. I'm really not happy.
I don't know what to say to you about being optimistic or pessimistic. I want to say that everything would be okay soon, but I can't say that. What I do know is that you've just got to decide to be optimistic at the moment.
Al-Attar is similarly optimistic, believing that even if it takes a long time, those in Syria fighting for democracy will win. Right now, though, he says there's no chance his play could be seen in Syria. But he says that's all right, because the greatest drama in his country is the one he's witnessing now.
People are creating wonderful stories every day on the street, and we can see it through YouTube, through TV. These stories are much, much, much stronger than any play or any movie, really. art is a very important tool. I'm a great believer in rule of art in the most difficult contexts and situations. But people, the courage they show on the street is the great lesson. And it's much stronger than any fictional work you can present.
For The World, I'm Laura Lynch in London.
People in Israel are also out on the street. They're not trying to bring their government down, though. They're protesting the high cost of living. The demonstrations began a month ago with a tent camp in an upscale part of Tel Aviv. They've broadened since then with calls for social and economic justice, improved education, and workers' rights. And the protests are spreading. The government has appointed a commission to look at the protesters' demands. To get a better understanding of those demands, The World's Matthew Bell took a tour of Tel Aviv's tent camp.
My tour guide was Guy Sherritt. He's a Hebrew language teacher who's been using the huge tent encampment in Tel Aviv as his outdoor classroom. Protest slogans in Hebrew are everywhere on posters, banners, and pieces of cardboard. Sherritt offered to do a walking tour of the protest signage with me. We started with one that refers to the nargila. It's a water pipe for smoking tobacco.
It says, "Anachnu im nargila, hu im cigar." We are with the nargila, he is with the cigar. The context here is that the government claimed that the protesters are nargila smokers and sushi eaters. But as a take on that, people wrote here a banner, "We are with the nargila, he is with the cigar, hu im cigar." And they refer to Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, who loves his good cigars and the Dolce Vita, as everybody knows. So
the point being sort of he's the fat cat, he's with the tycoons, we're with the people. And corruption is one of the themes here with the protesters. So let's move on and we'll look at some more signs.
Okay.
Okay, here are a couple of signs hand-painted on cardboard. And what do they say?
This one is the main slogan of the protest. Ha'am Doresh Tzadik Chevrati, and we see the Star of David in the middle. The people demands social justice. And this is the strongest, and I think it's a very easy-to-grasp content as well. In a way, many people feel that like the pact between us as citizens and our government was broken, and we want it back.
This is also a play on the chants from Egypt, from Tunisia, the people demand the fall of the regime.
Exactly, it's Ha'am Doresh, it's exactly, people demand, it's exactly the same beginning as their slogan. We're standing next to a sign which says, "Revolution, you do it with love or you don't do it at all." And it's a take on a commercial for hummus that is to say, hummus, you do it with love or you don't do it. And of course, this company, this brand said that we do it with love. That's why it's the best hummus.
What's the Hebrew expression?
Ma'apecha osim be'ahava o lo osim bichlal. It's interesting. We're standing now near the Palestinian-Israeli or the Arab-Israeli tent, which is a solidarity between Jews and Arabs. And the sign here says, "Im Rothschild lo yavo el Muhammad, Muhammad yavo el Rothschild." If Rothschild, we are in Rothschild Avenue, if Rothschild does not come to Muhammad, Muhammad will come to Rothschild.
And here, guys, is a big banner that's tied between two tree branches over the sidewalk. What does that say?
It says in Hebrew, "Kol Yisrael ohalim zeh lazeh," which is a take on a very famous and old slogan, which says, "Kol Yisrael arevim zeh lazeh." All the sons of Israel are guarantors for each other. In a way, we care about our fellow countrymen. And this one says, "All sons of Israel are tents to each other," because of the tent revolution here. So we are all the tent protesters.
And there will likely be more. Organizers are planning demonstrations in many other Israeli cities this Saturday night. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Tel Aviv.
Later in the program, surfing the river wave in Munich. And still later, when you turn, when your town turns global, what stays and what goes? This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com. ¶¶
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. The Japanese government has decided to create a new nuclear regulatory agency. A top official announced the move in Tokyo today. The current agency has been heavily criticized for its handling of the ongoing crisis at the tsunami-crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant. Its officials have been accused of giving misleading, confusing, or even contradictory information. In some cases, they reportedly failed to release what information they had, especially about radiation levels. So some Japanese and American volunteers have been going out with Geiger counters to gather their own data. The volunteers formed a group. It's called SafeCast, and its co-founder is Sean Bonner, who's just returned to Los Angeles from Japan. How did it work, Sean Bonner? Did you fly in and fan out?
Well, we have a group who's already based in Tokyo, and the people who came to town, we just teamed up and went for a measurement drive. We have multiple devices that are attached to the outside of the car as well as inside of the car to measure different levels. And then we have a big giant map of areas that we've covered and looked for holes in that and then drove up.
Where did you go and tell us what you found?
Well, so for this trip on Sunday, we drove all the way up to Koriyama and then over to the exclusion zone. We were on the road for almost 24 hours. What we found was some very high levels right at the border and in some of the surrounding area. We confirmed a couple of hotspots that we had measured previously, and we spoke with a number of residents from the area.
And so was what you found in terms of radiation different from what the government had come up with or anybody else?
Well, nobody's published data on that. That's part of the problem, and part of the reason that we're doing this is because the data just doesn't exist. We found that measurements can vary, you know, by 100% in a matter of feet. The numbers that have been published by either the government or by even other organizations, they're sort of giving one number in relation to an entire city, which is basically useless.
Did you get the impression that that was a frustration for people, or do they have more?
Yes, definitely. That's the number one thing when we're talking to residents. They're dying to find out what any kind of a reading is. We spoke with a woman on Sunday who has spent almost every day of the last 5 months or so trying to reach someone who can give her any kind of info about the readings around her house.
So what did you say to that woman? I mean, what could you tell her about what you've been able to find? Because obviously she wants to know if she should be there or leave.
Right, sure. So we were able to show her the readings right on the spot where we were standing.
How does she know what to do, though?
People are actually incredibly educated. When they're sort of stuck in this situation and it's happening around them, the amount of research that people are doing on their own is actually quite encouraging. All the residents we speak to, their biggest concern is that they just don't know what's around them. People who live within the mandatory evacuation zones, they're getting assistance to move. You know, there's no question that they have to get out. In the volunteer evacuation zone, there's no financial assistance for anybody who moves. Anybody who has a local business is kind of on their own if they want to leave the area. There's families that are sort of split up because some people want to leave, some people don't want to leave. There's stigma involved on a social level for, you know, people who leave and are considered deserters by their neighbors. It's a very, very stressful situation. And the fact that nobody has numbers for their specific area, they're making these decisions on whether to stay or go based on complete speculation. So we think that the most important thing to do is just give people as much of this data as we can possibly get so that then they at least have something concrete that they can, you know, base their decisions on.
You're going to be going back?
Oh, yeah. I've been there three times since the event, and I'll be back again as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you for talking to us. Sean Bonner, who's co-founder of SafeCast, talking to us from Los Angeles. Thank you again.
No problem.
You can explore the rest of our coverage of Japan following the effects of the earthquake and tsunami. It includes video and blog posts from my colleague Marco Werman's recent reporting trip to Japan. You can find it at theworld.org. A kiss on the cheek is a common form of greeting in many countries. In some places, it's two kisses per greeting. In some, it's three. Well, a group in Germany thinks there's no need for that in the workplace. The German Etiquette Society wants to ban busing in the office. It says the practice is a form of terror. Hans-Michael Klein is the Society's chairman. Now, isn't terror a bit strong?
Yes, of course it's strong, but it's good to be strong. What do you think? A lot of people are complaining to get kissed every day by the boss, by colleagues, and so on. And they say, please define a rule which forbids kissing in the office. It's not professional, and it's too close for the German culture.
For the German culture. Now, is this something that's not being done by Germans in the workplace? I mean, is it new?
We observe this development since the year 2000, and it's an increasing fashion. You know that in South America it's a part of the culture, and in France and in Spain as well, but not in our culture. We have a social distance zone of 60 centimeters to say hello, for instance, and shaking hands. And you can't kiss with 60 centimeters.
You can't kiss with 60. Well, you can do kind of an air kiss, but 60 centimeters, about 23 inches. And this, maybe you do carry a slide rule, but you're saying that that's the proper social distance, at least at the workplace. Now, if one does not want to kiss or be kissed at all once or more than once, what do they do?
Ladies are complaining. They say, I don't want to be kissed by every man. They think there is a hidden desire, a hidden erotical aspect in this play, in this game. I can't forbid kissing in the office, but I say, you can download a little paper from our homepage, two variations. The first is, please kiss me. I want to get kissed every day, every second. The next is, please don't kiss me. And you can put it on your desk, and everybody knows kissing is allowed or not. And I spread this notice only to the press in Germany, and I have no idea how the whole world is discussing this issue. It's so funny and so crazy.
It's crazy, but it's also kind of a relief given everything else that's going on in the world.
Yes.
And just because you're providing such a good diversion from everything going on this planet, I just want to ask you, and maybe you've been asked this in interviews, but there are some people who are going to say, look, this is just so German. I mean, you know, kind of less expressive and formal, and what you need is a good dose of Mediterranean blood.
I don't think so. You can't take one part of a culture. You have to care with the whole cultural context. For example, in South America, you get kissed every day, every second. You get touched 60 times within 1 hour. There are studies, scientific studies. They say 60 times an hour in South America, 10 times in the U.S., and zero, not a single time in England. This is a question of culture and body feeling. And the South Americans have a different body feeling, a body conscience. It's very, very close. And I love to get kissed in South America, and I do it as well. But I would never do it in Germany. We have a somehow cold character, you know, a distance between people.
That's Hans-Michael Klein of the German Etiquette Society, which has also issued a rule on how to deal with a runny nose in public. This is PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins. Coming up on The World, why the U.S. may soon be joined by other top economies on the credit downgrade list.
Even Germany, which, you know, famously has a tremendous commitment to repay its debt, is not really AAA anymore because it's going to be bailing out Spain and Italy and absorbing so much debt.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The big news on the economy today is about jobs. There is a dip in the number of new jobless claims. Translation, fewer Americans are joining the unemployment line. Investors on Wall Street took that to be good news, but nobody's putting on the rose-colored glasses just yet. Unemployment is still high overall, and it's tough to forget the ongoing aftershocks of that credit downgrade. It was almost 1 week ago that Standard & Poor's nudged the United States government from its AAA perch. Now many investors are wondering which AAA-rated country could take the next knock. The World's Jason Margolis has more.
By Standard & Poor's assessment, there are 18 safer places than the U.S. to invest your money. On the list, Austria, Canada, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Singapore, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, Australia, Guernsey, Hong Kong, the Isle of Man, and Liechtenstein. And then the one that really irks American pride, France. But that country has higher unemployment, slower growth, and carries a higher debt ratio. So I asked Harvard University economist Ken Rogoff, is the U.S. really a riskier investment than France?
No, clearly France doesn't deserve a higher rating than the United States, and that will soon evaporate. They have their own political factors. But this feels a little bit like, you know, a student who got the grade that they didn't want and is pointing at somebody else's paper who maybe was graded too high and then said, I should be graded high. The United States had very, very awful debt debate debacle, and it undermined our institutions. It undermined the power of the president, and it didn't point to any end. Forget about the economics.
That's what Standard & Poor's did when they clarified why the United States was downgraded last week.
Hello, and welcome to Standard & Poor's Credit Matters TV.
S&P uses five criteria to determine a country's bond rating. John Chambers, head of S&P's Sovereign Ratings Committee, said the first four are related to a nation's economy and how it manages its money. Here's Chambers explaining the fifth factor.
You look at the political settings, you look at the political economy, you look at the ability of policymakers to respond in a timely fashion to keep public finances in a sustainable footing.
And that's where the U.S. fell short, says Frank Warnock at the University of Virginia's Wharton School of Business.
It's not just about the ability to repay, it's also about the willingness to repay. And what Congress has shown us is that they are willing to dangle that, the threat of default, for political reasons.
France hasn't done that. But France does have its own set of political and economic challenges that the United States doesn't face, explains finance professor Donald Smith at Boston University's School of Management.
The U.S. can create dollars, but a European country cannot just produce euros because it's a shared currency. So it's different. So I can understand where one might say the ability of Italy or Spain to pay off debt denominated in euros, you know, might be questioned given economic problems.
Questions spread to France this week. The three credit ratings agencies, S&P, Moody's, and Fitch, said yesterday that France's credit rating was not at risk. Still, it's just a matter of time before more downgrades come, says Donald Smith.
This act of downgrading the U.S. then raises the challenge to everyone else. Any country that's rated above the U.S. is going to be questioned.
And it's not just France that should be worried about losing its gold standard rating. Everybody in the eurozone is caught up in the continent's economic problems, says Ken Rogoff.
Even Germany, which, you know, famously has a tremendous commitment to repay its debt and to financial stability because of the scars of World War I and World War II and the horrible inflations they had afterwards, even Germany is not really AAA anymore because it's going to be bailing out Spain and Italy and absorbing so much debt, it's going to have trouble.
But all of this talk of downgrade, it doesn't signal the end of Western civilization. Ken Rogoff says we're not talking about top-tier countries defaulting on loans.
We're talking about AA+. It's still investment grade. It's still very high investment grade.
Frank Warnock says the difference between a AAA rating and a AA+ rating, well,
I don't think that there's much of a difference, really. Does France deserve a higher rating than the U.S.? I don't know. I mean, these are all roughly the same to me, right? AA+ versus a AAA. There's not much of a difference there.
For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
President Barack Obama spoke on the telephone today with Turkey's prime minister. The White House says the two leaders discussed the situation in Syria. Both renewed their demand that the Syrian government stop its brutal crackdown on protesters. That crackdown is also exposing religious rifts in Syria. The country is made up of a wide range of religious groups. Sunni Muslims are the majority, but the government is dominated by President Bashar al-Assad's minority Alawite sect, and there are also Christians, Druze, and Ismailis. Now, many minority groups in Syria are nervous that sectarian strife could break out, just as it has in Lebanon and Iraq. Ben Gilbert reports from Beirut.
Protesters hit the street almost every day in July, all across Syria. On one day last month, an activist who wants to be called Ahmed says another anti-regime march was held in the town of Qatana. The protesters were mostly Sunni Muslims, but with a mix of other religions. Ahmed says everything was peaceful until pro-government protesters showed up. They were largely from Syria's minority Druze community, he says trucked in from nearby villages. Ahmed says that's when the problems began and the rocks started to fly, allegedly documented in this video from Qatana. Ahmed says pro-regime thugs attacked the Druze to stir up sectarian strife, but pro-government Syrians say it was the anti-government protesters, who they call Muslim extremists, who attacked the Druze. Walid Jumblat, the major leader of Lebanon's Druze community, was alarmed when he heard about the violence. He's no stranger to sectarian conflict. He led the Druze militia during Lebanon's 15-year civil war. He says the Syrian Druze are in danger of being manipulated.
The Druze cannot, as being a minority, a very small minority, but to live with their brothers in Syria and being Syrian citizens and being with majority, which are Sunnis.
Druze only make up around 2% of Syria's population, so Jumblat was even more concerned when rumors spread that the Syrian Druze had asked their co-religionists in Lebanon to send them weapons. He says the rumor is false, but it does suggest that the fear is real. Jumblat says he encouraged President Bashar al-Assad to speed up his reforms and to keep the Druze out of the conflict.
I don't want the Druze of Syria to be used as scapegoats, and after all, we are just a very small minority, less than 500,000 scattered between Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. I mean, living in the sea of Muslims, be it Shiites or Sunnis, we cannot afford to have any challenge. We should accept that we are a minority, but part of a whole ensemble.
The Assad regime has long emphasized its ability to keep the peace between the Sunni majority and the Christian, Druze, and Alawite minorities in Syria, while Iraq and Lebanon burned with sectarian bloodletting. Ahmed, the activist, says that minorities like the Druze in Syria are torn between joining the anti-government demonstrations and keeping their heads down. He says he can't blame them.
They were living for the last five decades under an oppressive regime, but at the same time, it was also secure. They felt safe.
Christians are another minority that felt relatively safe in Assad's Syria. They make up around 10% of the population. This Christian activist, who asked his name not be broadcast, says the regime is using rumors and disinformation to scare minorities away from participating in the protests.
The government like spread news that this is a Sunni revolution, and when they will take the rule in Syria, they will kill and deport all the minorities, and they will suffer from that. So it's the main tool the government uses now, to be afraid, the minorities to be afraid from the Sunnis.
He says the government has ordered Christian priests to deliver sermons against the uprising. But he says some Christians, like himself, have been participating in protests, with more and more joining in the past 2 months. He says he's been welcomed by the largely Sunni protesters.
When the protesters discovered that I'm Christian and from the Christian era, some of them cried, some of them like just hugged me. They were saying like, Allah hayy aslak. You are from a good origin. Oh my God. They didn't believe that some Christians like are involved in this.
This activist says Muslims have welcomed Christians into mosques so they wouldn't be exposed to the brutality of the security forces on the street. At the same time, he says there's not an organized Christian presence at the protests, just individuals. That's because the Assad regime has been sowing the fear of sectarian strife for years, and it's a hard feeling to shake, especially for the older generation.
What really surprises me among some Christians is that
you know, they are so eager to believe the official narrative and the official story. I had a big argument with one of my uncles because he is very pro the regime, and I told him that I understand that, but I think on the humanitarian level, you cannot justify what has been happening in Syria.
Rima says the older generation seems to be growing more sympathetic to the uprising as the government-orchestrated violence increases. At the same time, another Christian, who has to be called George, says the government's fear-mongering may be working. What he sees is a situation where Christians are afraid of chaos, and Sunni Muslims, in turn, distrust Christians and Druze because those groups, on the whole, aren't joining the protests.
The situation is not as easy as some think. The Americans have been trying to spread freedom, but we've seen their model of freedom in Iraq. So as minorities, we don't feel safe. That's why we fear the regime being toppled.
George then asks, where do we go if Syria falls apart? Go to Turkey? They don't even speak Arabic there. Rami Nakleh says he isn't worried. He's a Syrian activist based in Beirut. He was born into the Druze religious sect, although he's secular. He says regardless of the consequences, bringing down Bashar al-Assad's regime would be worth it.
Whatever come after him, at least we will put our foot in the first step, because if we really manage to change this regime, we can change and reform any system will come after him. We know the tools now. People is politicized.
But analysts point out that unless the heavily populated urban areas of Damascus and Aleppo join the uprising, the dreams activists have of a time after Assad, or the fears some have of that time, will never be known. For The World, I'm Ben Gilbert in Beirut.
From the Middle East, our GeoQuiz today takes us in a different direction to southern Mexico. We're looking for a slice of land in southern Mexico. It's known as Mexico's Little Waste. It's the narrowest point between the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific. It's 125 miles across as the bird flies from the shores of Veracruz to the beaches of Oaxaca. That narrowness makes this a busy corridor, or did so before the Panama Canal was built. This is also a place known for its traditional Zapotec culture and folk music. We'll sample some tunes when we reveal the name of this region in today's Global Hit. Now, Munich doesn't come to mind when you think of surfing. The German city is more than 500 miles away from the closest surfable beach. But people are surfing there. Though they're not riding an ocean wave, they're riding the river. Munich just held its annual surf festival, and reporter Tom Dreisbach went to check it out.
Munich's surf festival has a decidedly German flavor. Wooden boards carved in the Black Forest, beer-inspired T-shirts, and reimagined lederhosen.
Yeah, look like a leather short, but it's a board short, so you can go swimming with it or to the Wiesn by the Oktoberfest.
It's only the second year of the festival, and the businesses here are riding a growing wave of surf culture.
I'm standing on the banks of the Eisbach River in Munich's English Garden. This is the middle of the city. It's maybe a 10-minute walk from the subway, but it's also home to a growing community of urban surfers. There's a wave of green water, maybe 3 feet high, and it's constantly cresting. And so about a dozen surfers in wetsuits are taking turns riding and doing tricks for an audience of locals and tourists. There's a bridge right above the wave where you can probably get the best view of the surfing, and that's where a lot of tourists are crowded.
I'm so jealous. I can't. Like, the waves here are better than they are back home, you know, 300 days a year.
Eddie Rosenberg is one of those tourists on the bridge. He's a student at Florida State University.
I just asked the guys, I really want to go down there and surf, but no one's really too cool with letting me use a board.
Yeah. You're trying to surf right now, you mean?
I'm wearing my bathing suit right now. I want to go in so bad.
Down below, Philip Köstring is just getting out of the river and taking off his wetsuit.
Yeah, es ist natürlich nicht so schön wie am Meer.
Of course, it's not as nice as the ocean, he tells me. It's more like a surfing simulator.
Aber es hat auch seinen Charme, ja?
But it has its own charm, he says. Because the wave's in the middle of the city, he can leave work and start surfing a few minutes later. Concrete blocks beneath the surface of the river create the wave, but local surfers have modified and improved the flow by installing wooden planks. People have been surfing here for close to 40 years, but it was only last year that the city officially legalized river surfing. Now it's estimated that around 500 local surfers frequent the Eisbach. But for outsiders, it remains an oddity. How does a culture of surfing thrive so far from the beach? Sebastian Steutner is a professional surfer from Nuremberg. Last year, he won Billabong's Big Wave Award for his ride on a 66-foot wave in Maui. I asked him why surfing on the relatively tiny Icebox wave has taken such hold here.
Because surfing is a lifestyle. Anywhere you go in the world, there's surfing stores with surf shorts, t-shirts, and the lifestyle is very big, but the actual act of surfing wasn't possible. And those stationary waves or river waves make it possible, and I think that's the big attraction about it, and it's great for surfing.
When he was 16, Steutner moved to Hawaii to learn surfing, but the next generation might not need to make such a drastic move. His hometown of Nuremberg plans to build its own river wave next year. For The World, I'm Tom Dreisbach, Munich.
You can check out Munich's river surfing for yourself. We've got photos and videos of the action. They're at theworld.org. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. This is traditional music from a part of Mexico known as the country's Little Waste. It's in the south and the narrowest point between the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific Ocean. It's called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and that's the answer to our geoquiz today. The villages and cultures of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec are the subject of a new book that's called No Word for Welcome: The Mexican Village Faces the Global Economy. Wendy Call is the author. For the past decade, she's made yearly trips to the region, and she's seen it change as it becomes exposed to the global economy. Even so, Wendy Call says the history of the Isthmus helps to keep its traditions strong.
There has been a lot of interest in this little place for a very long time. People have come from Europe before Europeans came. The Aztecs moved through this region in order to get to what we now think of as Central America. And so the villagers who live there are accustomed to having people from the outside come through, sometimes for benign reasons, sometimes not so benign. And perhaps as a result of this, they are very, very fierce in protecting their home place.
You made your first trip there in 1997, is that right?
Yes.
And moved there in May of 2000, 11 years ago.
Yes.
What was it that specifically drew you there?
I had been working as a grassroots organizer in Seattle and in the Boston area, and I was really interested in how communities organize themselves, and I started to become interested in how this would function in a place that was very different from the society that I had grown up in the United States. And I heard about this place, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and that there were some very strong community organizations there. And I was stunned by what I found in terms of the level of organization, the sophistication of the villagers, and how they thought about the way that their little region of Mexico fit into the global economy.
Which is kind of unusual, I mean, especially in an area that is so localized. Can you give us examples? I mean, how did they see themselves in the larger picture?
Well, there were some things that are cultural. For example, the outfits that women wear, particularly at fiestas, which would be familiar to us because they're the outfits that Frida Kahlo, the painter, the Mexican painter, wore. Those outfits incorporate aspects from European fashion, from Chinese silk, And the way that they look is they're short embroidered sort of square tunics that are in bright colors with very brightly colored embroidered flowers on them.
And so that's, I mean, in an outfit, that's kind of a picture of the way globalization has been either embraced or imposed on the villagers?
Exactly, in terms of people incorporating what is useful to them and not incorporating what's not useful. To give a more contemporary example, there was a preschool teacher who I spent a lot of time with when I lived there, and it used to be that when I wanted to go to visit her, I had to call one of the two telephones in town. This is a town of 10,000 people. It had two telephones. Now she has a cell phone, and she got the cell phone when she was pregnant with her first child. And when her labor pains started coming 6 weeks early, it was the middle of the night, she panicked, and she was able to use her cell phone to call the hospital in the city, which is about an hour away ride, and ask the doctors there what she should do. And being able to do that ended up to her being able to save her baby and her daughter surviving.
Can you see the change when you first enter the village?
You can't really. That's one thing that's interesting. People's homes look the same as they did. This is a region right on the coast, and so there are fierce winds coming off the Pacific Ocean almost all the time. And so when you first enter the village, what you see are these high reed fences that are built and look the same as they have, you know, for literally hundreds of years. Another thing that hasn't changed, in part due to the work of people like this preschool teacher, is that people still speak their local language. And keeping those languages alive when you have radios and televisions that are talking to your children all day and all night only in Spanish is a difficult thing to do.
There are like 10 local languages there.
Yes.
So how do they keep them alive? It has to be a concerted effort.
It is a concerted effort. And the fact that different villages have dealt with that differently means that some of those languages are vibrant and healthy, and there are magazines published in the languages, and others are increasingly spoken less and less by the children. And so some of them are now considered sort of language of the elderly people. But there is an effort in some villages to stop that loss, where they'll have elders who are teaching language classes to small children. And now you have interesting communities where the elderly people and some of the children speak the language, but the people in between don't. They speak only Spanish.
Wendy Call, as you know, we end the program every day with a global hit, and you've brought along a couple songs from this region, one of which we began the interview with. And I wonder if you can take us out with one particular piece of music and tell us what the status is of the local music and to what extent this might be in danger.
One of the songs that I brought today is called La Tortuga del Arenal, which is the turtle who lives in the sandy place, is how you would translate that. And this is a very, very old song from the village of San Francisco del Mar. There's a very elaborate dance that goes along with it that tells some of the history of this village. And this recording that we're listening to is musicians in training. They're between the ages of about 9 and 14.
Is there any sign that music like this is on its way out, or is it being as embraced as other things like the clothing and the language?
The music really is being embraced. Of course, it has a lot of competition. One really strong aspect of Isthmus of Tehuantepec culture is that it takes its arts very seriously. And some of the best-known writers and artists in all of Mexico, the painter Francisco Toledo, the writer Andrés Enestrosa, those people are from this little known region of Mexico because the arts in all their forms have really been fostered there.
You mentioned the writer Enestrosa there, who wrote this about the place, and maybe this is a nice note to wrap up with. He says, it's small, it fits in the palm of your hand, it doesn't weigh heavily on the shoulders, yet it overflows the heart. I think you probably could have written that too, Wendy.
Well, when I read that for the first time, I thought, oh, that's exactly how this place has made me feel, and I've only been here for a few years.
Well, Wendy Call, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fabulous to be here.
Wendy Call's new book is called No Word for Welcome: The Mexican Village Faces the Global Economy. You can see a slideshow of the people and villages in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec at theworld.org. Before we go, here's a shout out to the winners of today's GeoQuiz texting game. They are Lillian in Aventura, Florida, Charles in Montebello, California, and Maggie in Columbia, South Carolina. You too can play along next time. Just text GeoQuiz, one word, to 69866. You'll get the hints before the broadcast. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Lisa Mullins. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and NASA, leading research on the Earth and its climate from the vantage point of space.
PRI, Public Radio International.